Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 8th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, another step toward a universal flu vaccine, nuclear waste after Yucca Mountain, and insights on spinal cord repair after injury. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A paper published online this week by Science reports on a newly identified antibody that may broadly neutralize a major group of influenza viruses. The paper, by Damien Eckert of the Scripps Research Institute, Robert Friesen of the biopharmaceutical firm Crucell Holland, and 18 colleagues, shows that the antibody targets an antigen sequence, or epitope, on group 2 flu viruses that's highly conserved over time, and thus resistant to mutation. Several years ago, the same team identified antibodies that broadly neutralize the so-called group 1 viruses, the other main subtype of influenza A viruses. Since group 1 and group 2 viruses constitute almost all of the strains implicated in both seasonal and pandemic influenza, the team says, the new discovery may put the world one step closer to the ultimate goal of a universal flu vaccine. One of the paper's senior authors, Ian Wilson, spoke with me about the study from his office at the Scripps Research Institute in San Diego.
So the main issue that we were trying to look at in this study was that we had previously shown that we could find neutralizing epitope for group 1 viruses of influenza virus. Influenza viruses are divided into two groups, group 1 and group 2. There are 10 viral subtypes in group 1 and 6 in group 2. And we had previously shown that there was an antibody that could recognize pretty much all of group 1 viruses, and we were interested to find out whether there was another such epitope that would account for the group 2 viruses. So in collaboration with Crucell, the study was really to sort of identify antibodies that actually could bind to group 2 viruses. Crucell is a biopharmaceutical company in Leiden in the Netherlands.
So how does work like this proceed? Do you identify the antibody first? Do you identify the target region on the virus? Could you just take me through how you do a study like this?
First of all, you start with the antibodies, and basically you do a selection of trying to find antibodies that will cross-react between different subtypes of viruses within a particular group, such as the group 2 of influenza virus. And so Crucell did all this work, and they basically selected from the blood of people that had been immunized with the normal seasonal vaccine, and they basically looked for antibodies in the blood of these people that actually could cross-react with different subtypes within a particular group of influenza viruses.
And so then once you've identified this antibody and established that it's effective, you next sort of try to establish what it actually targets on the virus?
Yes, the next step is then to try to figure out exactly where it binds on the virus. We know that from the way it was selected that it's going to bind to the hemagglutinin, which is the major surface antigen on influenza virus.
So that's the so-called HA area?
That's the HA, and that's an H is the, when we hear about H1N1, H5N1, H refers to the hemagglutinin, the subtype of the hemagglutinin.
And why the hemagglutinin in particular?
Because that is the major surface antigen on the virus. It's the molecule that actually allows the virus to be able to bind to cells. It has a receptor binding site. So it binds to sialic acid receptors on the surface of our cells, and particularly in our lungs. And it also has another activity, and that is membrane fusion. Because influenza is an envelope virus, that means it has a membrane, and these viral antigens, such as the hemagglutinin, protrude through that membrane. But in order to get the genetic information inside the cell, then one has got to fuse the viral membrane with a host cell membrane. And so there's a fusion activity associated with the human glutenin, and that allows the viral membrane and the host cell membrane, endosomal membrane, to actually fuse together and deliver the gene segments, the code for the influenza virus proteins, into the cell.
Okay, and so you knew you were targeting something on the hemagglutinin stalk. How do you zero in on what that is?
To do that, one can do a variety of things. One can actually look at mutants of the virus, so you can actually selectively try to determine by that means how what region the antibodies might be targeting on the virus. Or you can do it more directly by using X-ray crystallography, in which we take the hemagglutinin protein and the antibody, you mix them together and you grow crystals. And then by using a process called X-ray diffraction, you can actually then reconstruct the three-dimensional structure of the antibody and the hemagglutinin and determine directly where the antibody is binding on the hemagglutinin.
So you've isolated this antibody and you've determined where on the virus this antibody actually does its work. My understanding is that, you know, we have different annual flu vaccines because the virus is so effective at mutating and creating new versions of itself so that one year's vaccine, you know, might not be effective against next year's strain. What makes this group 2 antigen that you've identified different?
Well, most of the antibodies that normally target the virus do so to the so-called head region of the virus rather than the stalk or the stem region where these group 1 and group 2 antibodies are targeting. The head region is very hypervariable. It can mutate very easily. And so it's much easier to escape from an immune response, which is why we require a new vaccine every year. But if you target something which has much more highly conserved because there's a lot of function associated with that region, such as membrane fusion, then it's a little harder to escape from. This region is also a little bit more inaccessible on the virus itself, and you don't seem to get antibodies as readily to this region as you do to this almost a decoy region on the top of the molecule where all the hypervariable residues are.
In your paper, you say that having this new antibody for group 2 viruses combined with the group 1 antibody that you mentioned was discovered a few years ago raises the prospect of a universal flu vaccine. How universal are we talking about here?
Well, for the moment, we're talking about influenza A viruses, but influenza A viruses are the viruses that have caused us most of the major pandemics, or all of the major pandemics and epidemics in the last century or more. For example, in 1918, 1957, 1968, and the recent swine flu, these were all caused by influenza A viruses of various subtypes, H1, H2, and H3 subtypes. So now we have 2 different antibodies that really cover all of those types of viruses that actually have caused these major pandemics in the last century or more.
But there are presumably other kinds of flu besides influenza A that are maybe less common that aren't going to be covered by something like this.
There's influenza B, and in the current vaccine, you're immunized against 2 types of influenza A and as well as influenza B. So influenza B does cause illness, but it doesn't cause the same mortality as influenza A viruses.
So how far do you think we are away from the sort of universal vaccine that this might open up the way for? What are the next steps in that?
Well, up until 3 years ago, we had sort of inklings, but we didn't have really good experimental proof that these conserved epitopes existed, these conserved regions to which antibodies could target. And so I think now we are in a position that we know where those regions are, and now we'd go into design phase, trying to figure out how we can use this information to design effective antigens, or we would actually call them immunogens, that would be able to elicit that response when given as a vaccine. That is clearly also a very difficult and challenging task. But now that we actually know what the blueprint is for such an immunogen, the next phase and what's going on at the moment, certainly since these group 1 antibodies have come out, is to be able to actually use that information to start some design work to create such an immunogen.
Ian Wilson, thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ian Wilson is a senior author on a paper by Damien Eckert, Robert Friesen, and colleagues on a newly identified antibody that targets Group 2 influenza viruses. You can find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. The canceling last year of the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository in Nevada, after 24 years of development and controversy, left the U.S. without a clear long-term strategy for handling vast amounts of radioactive waste generated from nuclear power. In a News Focus article in this week's issue, Science news writer Eli Kintish reports on an upcoming study that will make some specific recommendations on the way forward. Here's Eli Kintish.
So last year, President Obama announced that the U.S. would be canceling the project to develop a repository for nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And at the same time, he announced that he was setting up a commission in Washington to figure out what to do with the nuclear waste problem in the United States as a result.
Well, take a moment to refresh my memory here. What exactly happened with Yucca Mountain? I mean, why did that project go down?
So in 1987, a law was passed in the United States that essentially mandated that the Yucca Mountain site in Nevada would be the place for American nuclear waste. Since that time, however, fights in court, red tape in Washington, and political wrangling have prevented any of the tens of thousands of tons of American nuclear waste from being put into this repository. And remember, Stuart, this waste requires tens or hundreds of thousands of years of storage because it remains first hot and then radioactive for that period. President Obama essentially struck a deal when he was elected that he would kill the project because Nevada is an important state politically, although he's never said that explicitly. No scientific or technical rationale was given as to why this site was no longer on the table. Essentially, they said, because of the political opposition to it, we want to find an alternative. That's when he set up the commission, which my article gets into.
Well, let's talk about that commission. It's now sort of recommending a slightly different approach with some sort of interim facility.
One of the challenges of Yucca Mountain was that nuclear waste requires cooling for about 50 or 80 years, and then this long-term storage to prevent human or environmental exposure to the very powerful radiation that this waste creates. Yucca Mountain was going to first cool the waste and also permanently dispose of it in the repository. And so one reason that separating those two functions makes sense is that you can more efficiently cool the waste out of doors in protected casks, and then you can have a repository whose function is more focused on storage over the long term. Another reason that interim storage in outdoor casks makes sense versus storing the waste in a repository is that by storing it in an interim basis outdoors, in case it turns out that you can actually use some of the waste in to actually make fuel by recycling it, you have easier access to it.
And so in some sense, these arguments are maybe attacking some of the scientific arguments that were raised against Yucca Mountain. I mean, wasn't there an issue in Yucca Mountain with, for example, this notion that the fuel was still hot, etc.?
There were some technical problems that Yucca Mountain scientists had to confront. Another article in our mini package about nuclear waste this week gets into how scientists ultimately succeeded at addressing each of those issues. One of them was how water might interact with the waste over time. Another issue was how much heat might be actually created by the waste over time, how that heat might affect the steel or the titanium elements of the repository. Ultimately, however, the 20 years of the Yucca Mountain Project definitively proved that you could store nuclear waste for 10,000 years or even the million years that they were talking about without technical snags.
Well, okay, so now we have this recommendation for interim cooling or some sort of interim facility, but that, as the name implies, is just an interim solution. Don't we still need a long-term solution for this?
There's no question that the interim storage has advantages and disadvantages from a political perspective. The first advantage is that it might buy you time to develop a process of setting up a repository which is less acrimonious than the Yucca Mountain effort, which had lots and lots of political problems associated with it. But on the other side, politically, it means yet another place that you'll have to put nuclear waste, which might mean new political fights. So you could actually have to fight one fight to argue for placing this interim storage site in somewhere like Nevada or somewhere else, and a second fight to actually develop a repository. A central part of what the commission is calling for is a more inclusive, more open, more friendly process of figuring out where the waste ought to go. And they point at Sweden as one country which has successfully actually set up nuclear waste repository. They've yet to put any long-term waste in that repository, but compared to Nevada, the experience with Sweden is a lot less acrimonious. And one of the reasons the commissioners say is that Sweden used process which simply was less the government forcing a community to take the waste, but rather communicating and being more open about it. So they're hopeful that in the future, a different system could lead to communities wanting the waste. And that doesn't seem that crazy when you realize that this might lead to jobs. It might lead to a steady source of income for a community. And that even here in the United States, in New Mexico, for example, there is a facility where nuclear waste actually already is stored. It's called WIP.
That's the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant?
Right. That waste is shorter term. It's radioactive over several decades instead of eons. And the reason that that site seems to have succeeded politically is that local officials in New Mexico have viewed it as safe. They've been convinced of the science around it. And secondly, they view it as a source of jobs. And in fact, it has helped a local community in New Mexico.
You mentioned earlier something interesting about sort of buying time to find perhaps ways to reuse this waste or something like that for energy production. How realistic is that, or how close to technologically to that are we?
Scientists have been developing methods to recycle waste since the 1950s. And in fact, the French use a technique where they chemically treat spent nuclear fuel, which is the bulk of the U.S. nuclear waste, to create a new kind of fuel, which they burn for a second time in reactors. This process, however, creates plutonium, which can be used to make nuclear weapons. And so for that reason, most experts believe that this is not a viable solution for nuclear waste. And plus, it's not clear how much you actually save in terms of the total amount of nuclear waste that's created as a result of this process. However, the U.S. government and a number of other countries have been doing research into other types of advanced reprocessing that might not create plutonium, or might create plutonium, but in a way that is so radioactive that thieves or terrorists trying to obtain it to make nuclear weapons would be unable to get close to it. That said, one of the findings of this commission is that we are so far away from a technical solution using reprocessing that we cannot rely on that, and that repository and relatively short-term cooling has to be the basis of our solution for nuclear waste.
Eli Kintish, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Stuart.
Eli Kintish writes about the upcoming report of a Blue Ribbon Commission on Nuclear Waste Handling in a news focus in this week's Science. Developing the right approach to spinal cord injuries requires understanding the complex process by which scars form in the central nervous system. A paper published in Science this week provides some new insight on that process. In particular, it focuses on the key role in spinal cord scar formation played by a class of cells not previously associated with central nervous system injury repair. The paper's corresponding author, Jonas Friesen, talked with me about it from his home in southern Sweden.
So we and many others have for a long time been interested in understanding how scar tissue is formed in the injured central nervous system, and we actually stumbled on a completely unexpected cell type generated a very large part of the scar tissue.
Yeah, let's talk about that scar tissue. At the outset of your paper, you mention essentially that there are two components to scar tissue in a central nervous system injury, a glial and a non-glial component. Could you explain a bit more what that means?
So it has been recognized for more than 100 years that scar tissue is formed at injuries in the central nervous system. Rather than the tissue being replaced, we get the scar forming there. And there's very many glial cells there, which is a special type of supporting cells of the nervous system that form a large part of the scar. And they're very obvious when you look at sections in the microscope.
Glial cells being a form of essentially nervous tissue.
Yes, they are part of the nervous system, and the name glia actually comes from the same word as glue. So they were originally thought to glue together the nerve cells to form the nervous system. So they're a specialized type of supporting cells. That.
And then there's this other component.
Yes. So what we found was that there's also a very prominent other component, which is a type of connective tissue or fibroblasts. And it has been recognized in some papers that there are not only glial cells, but there are also connective tissue cells or fibroblasts. But by being able to label them genetically and follow them from their origin to visualizing them through the process of scar formation, we could actually see how many they were for the first time, and that they actually outnumbered the glial cells, and that they form a very large part of the scar, and they form pretty much all of the core of the scar tissue.
And these cells in the connective tissue, I think you focused in particular on this class of cells called pericytes, if I have that right?
Yeah.
What are those cells, and what makes them of particular interest here?
Pericytes are cells that line the smallest blood vessels. We have pericytes lining all our smallest blood vessel, the capillaries, throughout the body. And they have functions in regulating some properties of the blood vessels. But it hasn't been very well understood of their exact function in the adult body. But what we find here is that a small subset of these cells, so it's about 10% of these cells, that respond very strongly to an injury. So from being rather few in a tissue section of the spinal cord, they multiply very dramatically in response to an injury. So their number increased about 25-fold in just a matter of 2 weeks. So this rather small population generates a very large population of cells, which migrates to the site of injury and there builds up the scar tissue, which then is important for reconstituting the integrity of the tissue. So when we genetically blocked this reaction so that the pericytes could not give rise to these scar-forming connective tissue cells, instead of forming a scar tissue, they developed holes in the spinal cord where the injury had been done.
So essentially, these pericytes were really essential to actually healing the injury.
Absolutely. So if we block the pericytes from generating new daughter cells, from going through cell division and generating new cells that then migrate to the injury, the spinal cord failed to seal the injury and regain tissue integrity. So instead of forming a scar tissue, which, so to say, glued together the tissue, these animals developed holes in their spinal cord instead, showing that these cells are absolutely essential for this scar formation.
Is part of the novelty here that you were seeing the operation in the central nervous system of a kind of cell that tended to be associated with another system of the body?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of the surprise, because it has been thought that it's been a business that has been handled by the nervous system cells themselves. But there's a completely different class of non-nervous system cells playing a central role.
So let's talk a little bit about the larger significance of this. I have seen some recent work, including a paper, at least one paper in Science, about scar tissue in spinal cord injuries, and in particular that scar tissue can be an impediment to the regeneration of neurons after spinal cord injury. Does your work here sort of cast any light on that, or, you know, does it suggest any different therapeutic directions for spinal cord injury, anything like that?
There has been a large interest in the role of scar tissue in recovery after nervous system injury, and in particular spinal cord injury. And it has really been difficult to completely establish the role of the scar tissue. There's good evidence that it blocks the regrowth of severed nerve fibers, but there's also good evidence that it actually protects from some further damage. Now, by knowing a central mechanism, as we think this is, in scar tissue formation, we can really address this much more precisely, and that is what we're just starting to do now, to see what is functional consequence of blocking this part of the scar formation. And I think by establishing a mechanism for scar formation and a cell type that is responsible for a large part of it now makes it possible for us to dissect what is the functional role for this and what happens if we modulate this process. So it does not at this point provide any answer or any new therapy, but it opens up many new questions which are completely addressable and which we and others will be able to answer now. And we can, for example, assess whether certain therapeutic strategies that have been attempted affect this aspect of scar formation. And we can also very directly interfere with this process and establish its role in regaining function and regeneration.
Jonas Friesen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jonas Friesen is the corresponding author on a new paper, A Pericyte Origin of Spinal Cord Scar Tissue. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with some recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, David, in the first story, a new way to fry tumors.
Right, Stuart, this story is all about using a technology or a strategy known as magnetic hyperthermia. And what this essentially means is trying to find a way to inject what are called nanoparticles, which are basically microscopic lumps of iron oxide or other compounds, inject them into a tumor, and then basically apply a magnetic field, have the magnetic field interact with the magnetic particles. Magnetic particles heat up and they get so hot that they essentially fry the tumor.
Wow. Clever idea.
It's a clever idea. And the reason researchers have gone with this approach in the first place is one of the hardest things about killing cancer cells is in so many ways they are so similar to all of our other body cells. So if we try to attack them with drugs, a lot of times those drugs kill the other cells in our body. That's why chemotherapy has such severe side effects. So what's interesting about this strategy is it's a way to target tumor cells themselves without affecting the rest of the body. If these tumor cells are filled with these nanoparticles and you apply this magnetic field, yes, the whole body feels the field, but only the cancer cells heat up and die. That's the idea anyways. This idea has been around for a little while. The problem is that it takes a lot of magnetic field to get these magnetic particles hot. And you have to inject a lot of these nanoparticles into the body, and they can themselves potentially be toxic. So this new study is all about trying to find a way to optimize this technology to get these nanoparticles to heat up a lot more than they do otherwise, and hopefully using that kill tumors. And that's essentially what these researchers have accomplished. They use a different compound this time with the nanoparticles. It's a sort of a two-layer setup where each nanoparticle contains a core of one magnetic mineral inside of a shell of another. And what this does is it actually, when a magnetic field is applied, these nanoparticles get about 10 times hotter than traditional nanoparticles do. So you don't have to apply as much of a magnetic field, and yet the tumors get super hot and the cancer cells get super hot when you apply this field.
Okay, so they have this new kind of nanoparticle. What did they do to test it?
Well, what they did was they took a few mice, and onto these mice, they grafted cells from a human brain cancer onto their abdomens, and then they injected these tumors with these core shell nanoparticles, and they placed the mice inside a coil of wire, which basically created this magnetic field. And when the mice were in this field, their tumors heated up to about 43 to 48 degrees Celsius, which is really hot. That's a temperature that would kill normal cells, and indeed, it killed the cancer cells. What the researchers found was that all traces of cancer disappeared from these mice after about 4 weeks with no apparent side effects. And that's actually even better than a common cancer drug that's out there called doxorubicin. When the researchers treated mice with this cancer drug, their tumors shrank, but they reappeared later on, whereas with the nanoparticles, the tumors seem to be gone forever.
Well, very promising. Is this something we'll be seeing added soon to the cancer treatment arsenal?
Well, it's possible. There's still a lot of concerns about nanotechnology, and especially nanoparticles, in terms of the toxicity. So there's probably going to be a few more tests and potentially some clinical trials that will need to take place to ensure that this therapy is both safe and effective for people.
And next, kind of the curse of the undead toads.
Right. Well, Stuart, cane toads are a real problem in Australia. They're an invasive species. They were introduced from South America in 1935 to control beetles that were destructive to sugarcane crops. And lo and behold, these cane toads ended up becoming even a bigger problem than the beetles ever were. They wreaked havoc on ecosystem because they're poisonous. So when creatures eat them, those creatures also die. But there's also an added potential problem, which is that conservationists are out there trying to kill these cane toads. These cane toads, are there so many of them, they end up on roadkill on the side of the road. And there's been somewhat of a concern that because these guys are so poisonous that potentially even after they die, and even after they've been out in the sun for months with heating up to temperatures as high as 49 degrees Celsius, the question is, are these guys still a threat long after they're dead? And in this new study, researchers showed that they actually are.
Okay, so how exactly do these toads reach from beyond the grave?
Well, to figure that out, the researchers actually collected 27 toad carcasses that have been lingering on the side of the road for about 2 months. So not the most appealing study design, but they brought these carcasses back to the lab and they actually soaked tissues from the carcasses in water. And one of the really surprising things they noticed right at the beginning was the poison-producing gland in these frogs swelled up, and it began to look like it did when these frogs were still alive. So it was almost like the poison control center of these frogs were coming back to life.
Hmm.
And beyond that, what the researchers did was they put these tissues in vats of water, and they introduced a bunch of species, fish, leeches, some other species that are native to Australia. And lo and behold, these species began to die after a few days, even though this tissue came from a cane toad that had died a long time ago. It was still full of toxin, and even though these toxins had been baked in the sun for months, they were still incredibly potent and incredibly deadly.
This must be a bit of a problem for the local health authorities.
Well, it is, because the conservationists and the people that have really been trying to control these toads thought that they were eliminating the problem by just killing these guys. And a lot of times when they killed the toads, they would just leave them where they killed them. They wouldn't collect them because they figured, well, now that they're dead, they no longer pose a threat. But this study shows that these guys can pose a threat long after they're dead. And it may lead to better conservation strategies, not to just get rid of the living cane toad, but also to deal with them once they've passed on.
And finally, speaking of coming back from the dead, scientists bring a very old audio recording back to life.
Well, that's right, Stuart. Now, before we start, I want you to listen to this sound clip. Now, what you're hearing, amazingly, is 123 years old. And according to a new study that just came out, this recording may represent the oldest known commercial record ever, and also the oldest known American recording of a woman's voice. Now, if you could sort of pick out what she was singing there, she's actually singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And why this new find is so amazing, in addition to the fact that it's a very old, potentially one of the oldest of these types of recordings that we have, is the way the scientists were able to bring this recording back to life. The recording was found on this warped metal disc, and it was actually made by Thomas Edison's laboratory in the 1880s. Around this time, Thomas Edison was actually trying to manufacture a talking doll. And essentially, you can see a picture of this doll on the website, but it was a doll for girls, and you would crank a little lever and the doll would sing to you. And this was even before people were even thinking about commercial records or anything like this. This was really the first way to get this technology into the hands of the public was as a toy.
So we have the soundtrack of a toy. What made it so hard to play back?
But the problem was that this record, as it were, was basically recorded by etching into this piece of metal. And the metal has become so warped, as you might imagine, over the last century or so, that it can't be played by any modern instruments, even can't be played by any old instruments that would have played it at the time, just because it's so warped. So what the scientists did, which was really cool, is they employed a confocal microscope, which basically takes very detailed images, and they imaged this thing to basically within an inch of its life. I mean, they imaged every little groove in the metal, everything they found. And by doing that, they were able to create a 3D reconstruction of what this record originally looked like. And then when they fed that reconstruction to a computer program, the computer was actually able to play the sound that you just heard a couple minutes ago.
Well, that's pretty cool. Are they going to be doing this with other archival recordings?
Well, they're really hoping to. Now that they've got this technology and they've shown that it works, they're going back and looking at a lot of these other old recordings. In fact, one of the next things they want to look at is one of the first attempts, or maybe even the very first attempt, to synchronize speech with a silent film clip. So a lot of history is really coming to life thanks to this new technology.
Okay, David, well, what else do you have cooking on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about how polar bears may have originated in Ireland, as hard as that is to believe, and also a story about the evolution of speech and language, how one gene may have been very important for that, and researchers are finally getting a sense of how exactly that gene works in the body. For Science and Cytosense's policy blog, we've got a story about the editors of a prestigious European medical journal stepping down amid controversy and what's going on with that. Also a story about how budget cuts are affecting NASA research, both in terms of science and in terms of some very important telescopes. And finally, on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about trying to color in the prehistoric world, what new scientific findings are telling us about what ancient birds look like, even what dinosaurs look like. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the July 8th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. Thanks to Carrie Klein and Andrew Green for their help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.